The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Show.
As the announcer of this show, I sometimes ask myself, to what shall I compare Eric? Shall I compare him to a summer's day? Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May.
But not Eric. I'll tell you, nothing shakes this guy.
And now here he is, wearing green leotards and a jester's coxcomb, Eric Metaxas.
Exit Todd, stage left.
Hey folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Kind of a sad day in America. Not kind of a sad day, sad day. Some terrible things have been happening in the country. I don't need to tell you, it's hard to avoid many terrible things, but the most recent terrible thing was the killing of George Floyd. We all know how horrible that is, but it seems to me that a number of people have hijacked what were peaceful demonstrations against the death, the killing of George Floyd. And in doing so, they have been looting, burning, stealing, potentially killing. We're not quite clear on whether this one individual who was brutally beaten has died. Cops have been targeted. And it seems to me that these activities desecrate the memory of George Floyd, who was a Christian, and that Antifa people, white people, violent people have hijacked what was once a movement of dignity, noble figures like Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., Jackie Robinson, and so many others would be the first to be horrified by the actions of what are mobs. These are not peaceful demonstrators. Many, I mean, of course, there are peaceful demonstrators, but there are also mobs, looters, people committing crimes who desecrate the memory of George Floyd and who desecrate the fight for civil rights and equality for blacks in this country. And it is absolutely heartbreaking to see this politicized in this way. In a few minutes, I'm going to interview Dinesh D'Souza. His book, The United States of Socialism, comes out today. Today's the first day for that book. So he'll be with us. He will cover current events with us. Also, in hour two, we're going to replay my interview with Pastor Anthony Thompson. Some of you remember his wife was killed in the Charleston massacre, where nine blacks were murdered by that young white man. And most of those involved in that church community chose very radically to forgive. Staggering level of faith and courage to be willing to forgive and to talk about forgiveness. Pastor Anthony Thompson spoke on this program about that. It is so radical, but it is the Christian way. It is what Dr. King spoke of. And it seems to me the only way forward. And that there have been people trying to hijack what is a noble movement of dignified people. And it's an ugly thing. And we need to kind of face it and figure out a way forward. Albin and Chris, before I give you a chance to talk, I want to say later on this week, we will have on Maura Moynihan, who is the daughter of former New York Senator Moynihan. I've known her for many years, and she wants to talk about the China situation. She's been very involved in the Chinese persecution of Tibetans and others. We're going to be talking to her. We also have Charlie Kirk on later this week. But right now, we just got a few minutes left. So, Chris and Albin, what are your thoughts on what happened last night? I mean, it's a chilling thing to live in New York and to know that any minute mobs may be coming up your street and looting stores and setting things aflame.
Well, Clint, if I can jump in here before Chris, you know, George Floyd's brother said that George would not be happy about what's going on right now. So, and you have mentioned, Eric, and I believe it's true, right? He is or was a Christian, was George. So he is on the side of peace and justice and righteousness and Martin Luther King. And John Zmirak pointed out something really excellently yesterday. And you guys, people have to go back and watch the video of John Zmirak's comments on all this. He said that that in all the world's history, the human history, there was no war to end slavery. Slavery's been around pretty much since the beginning of mankind, but nobody ever fought a war to end slavery specifically. And yet white and black people got together and said, enough. No more. It's done. Ended, right? 150, 160 years
well,
ago.
That's the whole thing. I mean, obviously, in my book on Wilberforce, Amazing Grace, I write about this. What an extraordinary thing that people, because of their Christian convictions, took a stand and without a bullet fired, ended slavery in the British Empire. And Wilberforce, because of his Christian convictions and his ability to forgive and treat with dignity even his political enemies, ended the slave trade because of his Christian faith. And then, of course, in this country, the abolitionist movement mostly was led by Christians. We know that the civil rights movement in America was led by Christians. Rosa Parks and Jackie Robinson and Martin Luther King Jr., these were devout Christians, and they spoke about forgiveness. They spoke about nonviolence. And what we're seeing right now is the antithesis of that. We're seeing revenge. We want revenge. We want to gin up anger. And, you know, I would say, hey, if that worked, we could talk about it. But it always backfires. It always causes more bloodshed. And to see the governments, to see Mayor de Blasio and the cops, in effect, allow this to happen so that people's businesses have been ruined. People have been terrorized. People have been beaten to a pulp. One person, I don't know if he died, that there was a report that he died. Cops are being targeted. The leaders of the civil rights movement who sacrificed their whole lives for this would be deeply, deeply horrified.
And there's a new phrase now, too, acceptable looting. It's okay to loot. It's acceptable. Some of looting is
I guess, isn't it racist if you say to some people, like, it's okay if you commit crimes because, you know, you can't help it. You're emotional. You have a right. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that really lends them any kind of dignity.
Chris, what do you have to say about this in New Jersey?
I mean, I think I was watching one guy describe the looting ideology, you know, sort of in acceptable terms, saying that, you know, for example, when America went to war with Iraq the first time, they plundered resources or whatever, and this is an opportunity to plunder resources and et cetera, et cetera. But it seems very short-sighted because, you know, there are a lot of business owners that are not going to tolerate it, and I'm very concerned for the looters that they're going to.
But how can somebody make a comparison with Iraq? Iraq was our enemy in a war. So
in Neiman Marcus,
you know, the owners of those stores and the, you know, it gets crazy. Also, there's a kind of a way of bullying. In other words, where people are demanding that someone take a knee, for example, right? And it really reminds me of horrible things in Germany in the 30s, where there was this kind of threat of violence that if you do not side with us, if you do not show with your body that you are with us in every way, you will be demonized. And there are many people that don't think taking a knee is a good thing. They may be right, they may be wrong, but the idea that they would be bullied on camera into doing things like that,
well,
it just doesn't feel like a wise way forward.
Right. I mean, it's really a heart issue. I mean, that's really what racism is. It's a heart issue. I mean, you have police that were kneeling kind of in the day, were the same people that, you know, were kind of being pretty physical moments later. So just from reports of
I think Dinesh is going to.
So it's you can take a knee, and then once the cameras aren't rolling, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. There you go. We're going to go to a break, but when we come back, I'm talking to Dinesh D'Souza for the whole hour. Do not miss it, folks. Thanks for tuning in.
Say goodbye to all my sorrow and bye tomorrow.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. As promised, my friend Dinesh D'Souza is on the program. Dinesh, welcome.
Hey, Eric, great to be on the show.
I want to talk to you about two things. First of all, current events, which is to say everything that's happening right now, a lot of tragedy, a lot of difficulty in America, but it ties in rather perfectly with your book, which is out today. Today is the launch day of your new book, The United States of Socialism, Who's Behind It, Why It's Evil, How to Stop It. And I just happen to have a copy right here in case anybody is interested in seeing what it looks like. Dinesh, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. I'm very excited. I wrote the book really before coronavirus, before these this outbreak of looting and rioting. And yet all these events couldn't be more ominous and couldn't be more predictive of the themes that the book is all about. So it feels like it explodes right out of the headlines.
I mean, yes, lucky for you or unlucky for the world, but who cares? Because there's nothing we can do about it except talk about it and try to bring some sense to the horror. I tweeted this morning that what has happened is that criminals, looters and arsonists and vandals have desecrated the memory of George Floyd, who was a Christian. And they have hijacked the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks and Jackie Robinson, all of whom would be absolutely horrified by the behavior of many people today. Now, we know that there are peaceful protesters, but it seems to me that the whole thing has been hijacked by Antifa thugs, by people who couldn't care less about George Floyd or about advancing the cause of Blacks in America.
Let me try to explain why that happens, why you get this kind of hijacking, which otherwise seems to be sort of unfortunate and accidental. Socialism originally was intended to be for the working class. Marx thought that society is divided into two camps, the workers and the capitalists. And Marx thought that the worker, for whom Marx had a lot of sympathy, the guy sweating and working on a dock or a foreman, that guy's working too hard, he's being exploited, he's at some point he won't take it anymore, and he's going to overthrow the capitalist class. So socialism was rooted in this class division. Now, interestingly, there has never been that kind of a worker revolt of the kind Marx predicted anywhere in the world from Marx's day until today. It's never happened. And so the left, going back now several decades, realized, well, you know, the working class is kind of unreliable. They're not going to be our proletariat. They're not going to do the job for us. In fact, today, if you look for a working class guy, particularly a white working class guy, you're more likely to see him in a Trump rally. So the left said, look, we need a new proletariat. We need new types of division that create new types of grievance, and we will try to mobilize these new proletariats to do what the working class will not do. And their primary candidate is racial grievance. The idea here is that, look, there is a real history of racial grievance. If we can tap the veins of that, if we can exploit that, we can make Blacks, in a sense, into the discontented class that Marx thought would be the working class. And so this is why the socialist left does this. Now, I call this marriage between classic socialism and identity politics, I call it identity socialism. And it shows that we're dealing with a new type of socialism that is not just about class division, but race division, gender division, division between legals and illegals, straights against gays. The left really divides society not just in one way, but in several different ways.
How is this, Dinesh, different from cultural Marxism. In other words, to me, what you're saying is the same thing. In other words, we have to divide people. We have to play, we have to pretend that that it's a zero sum game. We cannot create wealth. We cannot increase wealth. We've got one pie and it's a battle for who can get the most. And we're going to create our side versus their side. They're the oppressors. Isn't that also something we can call cultural Marxism in the way you've described it?
Yes, it is. But it takes socialism, I think, beyond its classic economic focus. I mean, if you look at socialists today, or even if you go to the Democratic Socialists of America convention, you will see like eco-socialists, Islamo-socialists, Afro-socialists, transgender socialists. So this shows the way in which cultural issues and cultural targets. One of the targets of socialism is always small business and private property. But here are some other targets: the family, the church, the moral order itself. So this is the way in which socialism tries to seize not just to confiscate your resources, but to control your movement, your freedom of assembly, your religious freedom. Notice how under coronavirus, those things were regulated, and the left is always trying to extend the regulation, and if they could, make it permanent.
Well, they saw an opportunity, and it is an amazing thing. You have to admit that in our lifetime, we've never seen anything like this. We've never seen anything where a free people, this free people, the American people, looked at the situation and said, yes, we will give up certain freedoms. We realize that it's probably prudent. We've never had anything like that. And so it's been, a class for American citizenry in what happens, how some governors handle it, how some mayors handle it, and how others handle it. It's really been, to my mind, clarifying.
Well, it is an exercise of the politics of fear. The left has realized that when the country is in a panic, people will agree to do things. Kind of like a crowd. A crowd doesn't behave rationally. A crowd moves according to panic. It stampedes. So how do you create a national stampede? Well, FDR realized, I'm going to ride in the Depression. The Depression creates the fear, and now I can do things that I couldn't do if we didn't have a Depression. And so since then, the left has been trying to replicate that model, invented if necessary. So in the 70s, you remember, the planet is running out of food. In the 80s, nuclear apocalypse. In the 90s, the ozone layer was dissipating. For the last 20 years, climate apocalypse. The world is going to end in 10 years unless you do these 11 things that we insist be done right now. And right. Coronavirus was perfect because it's an invisible enemy, as Trump says. And so people don't know, is this a legitimate threat? What is the degree of the threat? And so as long as you can put out a bunch of guys in white robes who say, listen, shut the economy down, we then obediently do it. Now we catch on. After a while, we begin to realize, wait a minute, Georgia's opening up, the Florida beaches are opening. We're not seeing any massive spike in infections. In short, we are kind of onto the con, and then we begin to realize, look, you tried to sucker us. We're going to be a little bit more difficult to sucker next time.
And of course, to go even further, the fear mongering of folks like Governor Andrew Cuomo led to sending coronavirus infected people into nursing homes, which killed thousands. So in other words, when you look at the death toll, a large part of that death toll is because people overreacted, not because they didn't react quickly enough.
That's absolutely right. And then look at this looting that's been going on in New York and elsewhere. And I'm trying to think about people like de Blasio and Cuomo. And I thought to myself, where does their kind of solicitousness or even sympathy for these looters come from? And I think it's because when guys like de Blasio look at a looter, they see a younger version of themselves. De Blasio himself was a kind of apologist for tyrannical socialist regimes in his youth. And in some ways, you can almost see socialism as doing in a sort of official or systematic way what the looters are doing in a disorganized way. So the looters smash glass, they go into a store, they grab the handbags, they run out. De Blasio would rather have an 80% marginal tax rate in which he shuts the business down or confiscates his and in an orderly way transfers its resources to the looters who are then committed to voting for him. So this is really the socialist game, and Antifa on the street is only the street version of it.
What do you make of President Trump declaring Antifa to be a domestic terrorist group?
Well, I think we should be careful here. Antifa is not a domestic terrorist group in the same way that, say, ISIS is, because Antifa isn't doing beheadings. They haven't even done what the Weather Underground did, which was set off bombs at the Pentagon and so on. But Antifa is a paramilitary wing of the socialist left. And what makes it dangerous, I think, most of all, is its allies in academia that taught them. You can almost say academia is the theory and Antifa is the practice, because academia says to these young people, hey, listen, this business with George, that's not anomalous. Cops are like that. America is structurally racist. We've been doing this to them since 1619. So now's the time finally to say enough. And so this resentment is cultivated in academia. And then you've got powerful people in Hollywood, in the media, even in the mayor's office and the governor's office who protect and defend these guys. That's why we have a national problem. It's, I think, similar to the paramilitary forces that Mussolini had, the black shirts or Hitler's brown shirts. They were ways of creating street conformity and street intimidation.
Right.
The left thinks they need that.
I was gonna bring up Hitler's brown shirts. That's what's chilling to me, that I've never seen that in my lifetime, and that now we have sophisticated thugs on the streets, really fomenting rebellion against the rest of us. We're going to go to a break, folks. I'm talking to Dinesh D'Souza, the author of a brand new book today, United States of Socialism. Don't go away. Christian bestselling author and speaker Richard E. Simmons does not shy away from the big questions of life. His latest book is called Reflections on the Existence of God, and it tackles the biggest question of all, does God exist? I've read this book, and I got to tell you, I'm a little biased, but you can imagine that I like it a lot, because Simmons offers insights for those grappling with life's biggest questions. Where do we find meaning in life? Who determines what is evil? Can we be moral without God? Does God even exist? Former White House aide Wallace Henley says, I've taught apologetics for many years and I've read every scholar mentioned in this book. Of all the books on apologetics, Simmons is the best I have ever read. This book is easy to read because it's divided into a series of brief essays, perfect for a devotional or discussion with a friend. I highly recommend that you add a copy of Reflections on the Existence of God to your pandemic reading list. Simmons asks questions that speak directly to one of the most important things you possess, your worldview. Folks, you know how important this is to me. Your worldview is going to impact the way you live your life for better or for worse. If you want to challenge yourself to spiritual and intellectual growth, and I hope you do, then be willing to ask yourself life's toughest questions. Dive in today by picking up a copy of Reflections on the Existence of God right now. Go to existenceofgodbook.com. That's existenceofgodbook.com. Hey there, folks. Welcome. I'm talking to my friend Dinesh D'Souza. He has a new book out today. It's called United States of Socialism. Who's behind it? Why it's evil? How to stop it? Dinesh, what led you to write this book specifically? You're very prolific. You've written many books. You typically deal with a big idea. This seems to me the big idea of our time.
Yeah. In fact, we came of age, Eric, at a time when it looked like socialism had collapsed. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the dissolution of socialism and communism in the Soviet Union, China and India moving away from socialism. So at one time, socialism dominated the planet. And then it seemed like it went poof. And there were just a few outposts, North Korea, Cuba, that socialism was really on the way out. And then suddenly in the 21st century, this idea that has never been in the mainstream of American politics. We've had socialist candidates before, Eugene Debs in the early 20th century, Norman Thomas, but they were always marginal. They never got mainstream support. Until now. And so I thought to myself, we've got to take on this new socialism. And it's not enough to take it on by just saying, hey, guys, it's never worked before, so it's not going to work again. Why? First of all, because we're dealing with this new type of identity socialism. But second, the left will say, hey, Dinesh, socialism does work. Look at Scandinavia. Look at Norway and Sweden. It's not so bad to live over there. You may not feel like living over there, but you can't say that those are horrible places to live. They've got a massive welfare state. So why don't we adopt not the Maoist model or the Castro model, but the Scandinavian model? So these were some of the ideas that got me to think, you know what? I think I need to take on this new socialism that is striking a chord with young people and offer not only an answer to it, but a political way to defeat it.
It seems to me fascinating, really, that because we have not taught civics in America and have not helped people understand what it is that has made America work and thrive and create wealth, we've allowed a vacuum, an idea vacuum. And so people can come in and have come in, of course, Bernie Sanders and AOC and the folks you have on the cover of your book. And they have sold a bill of goods that has never worked. You just said that it doesn't work, but somehow people, they haven't seen it not work. And so they have naive hope, and young people seem always to be the easy marks for this kind of marks, no pun intended, easy marks for this kind of thinking.
That's true. I also think that young people will say the Scandinavian model works, but they don't know what the Scandinavian model is. So the Scandinavian countries, for example, are capitalist in wealth creation. They're socialist in wealth distribution, but they're very careful not to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. And so you have low corporate tax rates, about 20%, same as in America. You have no minimum wage in most Scandinavian countries. They have no wealth tax, no inheritance tax. You can hire and fire people for any reason. Regulations are less than in this country.
Dinesh, I just have to hit pause for a second. Everything you've just said is stunning. I mean, the idea that they have low corporate tax rates, low wealth tax. I mean, you would never dream that in a country that people think of as socialist, that would be the case. Bernie Sanders is not advertising that.
No. And in fact, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren want to impose financial transaction taxes on Wall Street. Now, there's no Scandinavian country that goes near this. One Scandinavian country, Finland, tried universal basic income. They tried it for about 8 months. They got rid of it. They decided it doesn't work. So the Scandinavians, in other words, believe we need to create a wealthy economy. Now, the second part of it is they say, look, we can have a generous welfare state, but here's the point. Everybody has to pay for it, not just the rich. We're not going to go after the billionaires. The basic idea is if we have a 50% tax rate and you make $60,000 a year, give us 30. So in other words, they tax the middle class. And they also have a VAT tax, which is a consumption tax. That's 25%. And that falls disproportionately on the poor. So it would be fair to say that the Scandinavians do not soak the rich. They soak the whole society. No Scandinavian talks about free stuff because they know it's not free. Who's paying for it? They are.
And they know they are. Well, the key, of course, is whom do we trust? Do we trust bureaucrats to distribute our money, or do we trust ourselves or the free market? That, to me, of course, is the difference between freedom on the American model and that kind of a socialism. It seems to me that whenever you have what we call big government, there's corruption. You see it now everywhere. In other words, you have these folks who are governors or liberal members of Congress or the Senate who don't seem to believe in the people. They don't seem to believe that we, the people, are in fact the government. They have an elitist view that they know better. There's nothing really new about that. I mean, Buckley, I guess in the 60s, was saying that he'd rather be governed by, you know, the first 300 names in the Boston phone book than the Harvard faculty. He had this sense 50 years ago that the elites had a sense of entitlement and a sense that they should be the ones running things. And he knew that was fundamentally un-American. It seems we haven't moved from that idea.
Well, the socialist left, though, is clever because they talk about turning over the institutions to the people. If you listen to Elizabeth Warren carefully, it sounds like what she's saying is, why don't we have the people run healthcare? Why do we have to have the insurance companies? Let's turn it over to the... So the people, that's their rhetoric. Now, here's the key point. The people, in fact, have no say, right? What say do you or I have right now over the post office? None. What say do we have over the DMV? None. What say does the ordinary British guy have over the British National Health Service? None. So the people is a rhetorical smokescreen here.
We're not really talking
about the people.
Forgive me. We're going to hit pause. We'll be right back to continue the conversation with Dinesh D'Souza. Welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show, talking to Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, you were just making the point that those who advocate socialism, they always use the rhetoric of the people, but in fact, they have no intention of actually giving the people the right to do very much. That's, to me, that kind of sums it up very nicely.
This to me is the key, and I think I'd like to try to highlight what I think is the most original argument that I make in this new book, United States of Socialism, and it's this. The left basically argues that they want democratic socialism. In their words, we want to extend the democracy that we already have in the political sphere to the economic sphere. We want to give the people control over the economy. Now, here's my answer. The people already control the economy far more in a capitalist system than they do in a socialist system. Why is that? That's because in a capitalist system, we vote as consumers with our dollars every single day. You vote not every 2 years or 4 years. You vote constantly and you don't just vote. Look, your vote in politics costs you nothing. It's election day. If it's not raining, you go out and vote. It costs you nothing. But the money you spend in the market, that represents your effort, your time, your labor. It means something to you. You're not going to part with it unless you're getting something of value in return. So this is my point. Capitalism gets popular referendum in the form of people's hard-earned dollars on a constant reinforcing basis. We don't have to extend democracy from the political to the economic sphere because we already have it.
That's a brilliant point, one which I will repeat with attribution. But that really is. Let me ask you about China for a moment. I have to say that I have been fascinated, not necessarily too surprised, by the cravenness of American corporations in their dealings with China. They seem to have sold their souls for the bottom line, that they're willing to do business with people whose view of human rights in the Communist Party in China is not that different from slave owners in America before the Civil War. In other words, it's very, very dirty money, and they don't seem to be using the power they have to get leverage over the human rights situation. They simply seem to be willing to let it ride. And it seems that Trump is the first president we've had that has identified the problem and that is willing to take on China, which is, of course, a vast socialist communist power. What do you think of that situation?
Yeah, China is an anomaly because they have jettisoned, to a large degree, their old socialist economic system, but they have kept intact their political communist structure. And so you have something that has really not existed in the world is essentially a communist capitalist state, China. It's unique. And it is able to force people to do things using the communist political structure. And we're not familiar with this, but I think for corporations, you're quite right. They don't have any patriotic loyalty to the United States. They're happy to offshore, if you will, the slave labor. They're just looking at what, by and large, is called the China price. In other words, if they can make something cheaper over there, we're just going to get it over there, mark it up, and then sell it over here. So Trump is fundamentally, he's a capitalist, but I think even more than that, he's a patriot. And he loves the country, and he looks out for America's interests. And he's kind of not bashful about that. And that itself is a little bit of a shock, because even going back to Bush and even Reagan, there was an attempt to sort of camouflage American interests when you speak in the language of global trade. So I think Trump, in that sense, is redefining the Republican Party and essentially considering trade itself as part of the political process, which, of course, it is.
But isn't that the problem? In other words, if previous presidents had done the right thing, the monster that is now China would not be as big as it is, and we would not have to deal with it in this way. But it seems to me that the naivete and the greed of Clinton and the Bushes with regard to China, thinking that, you know, the god of the free market is going to solve the political problems in China and make them just like us. You know, that's one kind of stupidity. The other is just the pure greed of saying that, knowing that at least whatever happens, I'm going to make a lot of money in China. Hollywood has made that bargain. And then the liberal naivete that there's really no such thing as evil, that if we can make a buck, we'll be fine. But there's no evil to be dealt with in China. We've let this go on for 30 plus years. And it seems that you need someone like Trump to deal with them in the way that he's been dealing with them. At least that's what I think.
The Chinese have had a longstanding policy of getting favorable treatment from the leaders of other countries by financing their family members. It's an old kind of Asian despotic mode of doing business. Now, if you look at Biden, for example, over the years, Biden's net worth has not gone up for the simple reason that he has to disclose any investments that he has, any deals that he makes. But now watch the Biden family, his brother, James Biden, his other brother, Frank Biden, his son, Hunter Biden. Their net worths have skyrocketed. Why? Because when Biden goes to China, he takes Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden then gets a deal through the Shanghai Free Trade Zone that is not available to Western investors, in which the Chinese government itself is putting in money, a $1.5 billion investment. So here's the point. The American left financially benefits in this very direct way. And it's very similar to countries like Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez, in the name of the people, becomes a billionaire. His daughter is now the richest woman in Venezuela. By the way, this does not happen in Scandinavia. You can never name a Scandinavian politician who has gone from zero to $50 million on a government salary. But that's happened with the Clintons. It's happened with Obama. It's happened with Al Gore. It's happened with the Bidens. So socialism in America is a way of making nothing, not inventing the iPhone, not creating Amazon Prime, none of that, but nevertheless profiting enormously and getting rich.
Yeah. And you understand, Dinesh, I think, that this is called corruption. This is at the very heart of what destroys American-style self-government and liberty. And when I've talked in the past about why we need leaders of character, this is the principal kind of character. Do you put yourself and your own interests above the country, or don't you? It seems to me that whatever people want to say about Trump, you can't make the case that he's getting rich off of being president, but that you can make the case that previous presidents have effectively sold their souls to people, to the leaders of China and so on and so forth for their own aggrandizement, which is horrific. We're out of time. We're going to be right back. Final segment, folks, with Dinesh D'Souza.
That old wheel will roll around again. Yes, when love is...
The city streets are empty now. The lights don't shine no more.
Folks, I'm talking to Dinesh D'Souza. His new book out today, this very day, is called The United States of Socialism. Dinesh, what you just said about folks like Biden making their families rich by playing this corrupt game with China, you know, if it were only that, it would be very little. But the point is that the Chinese are not fools. They understand that for a few million given to folks like Biden and his family, for just a few million, they can buy things worth many, many billions, which, of course, costs America many, many billions. That seems to me what's been happening. And it is it seems to me treasonous or traitorous, but it's certainly corrupt.
Yes, it is. That's a very good way to put it. It's not expensive to buy off American politicians. And we know this in this country. I mean, if you're willing to give $25,000 to a political candidate, they'll return your phone calls, they'll listen to you, you'll be able to go to their house, and so on. So access in America is not that expensive politically. Now, try to imagine not just a Chinese tycoon or the Chinese government, but a Middle Eastern sheikh who's trying to get political favors from a... These are people who have oil coming out of the ground, who can offer, you may say, bribes in the millions, and also know that there are legal ways to pay those bribes such that you can then step back and Hillary just goes, oh, you know, they just made a donation to the climate change division of the Clinton Foundation. And then accidentally and coincidentally, I happen to favor these policies that have delivered billions of dollars to that particular entity. This is the socialist game. And I think the Democrats realize that when they speak of socialism, they're in a sense exploiting socialism itself, because it's not about the working class. It's not ultimately about making people equal. Orwell had it right. Some are, all the animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Final question with a little bit over a minute left. What do you think is going to happen with Durham and Barr going after some of the figures that have been investigating the Trump administration? Do you think this is going anywhere? Do you think anyone will go to jail?
I think they will, but I'm hoping it goes all the way to the top, because I cannot believe that Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and Comey and Clapper all thought of this themselves. They were like, let's go ahead and do this. Let's try to set up Trump. Let's try to set up Flynn. No way. These orders came, I believe, from Obama himself. He gave the order. And if that's the case, then the trail needs to go up to him. I don't know if it will. That man is more well protected. I mean, apart from the Clintons, who have stayed one step ahead of the posse for 30 years, Obama is extremely well protected. So I don't know. But I will say that shutting down the deep state, overthrowing digital censorship, and taking these Antifa thugs off the street, we've got to do all those three things to have a level playing field and return to an era of civility and genuine debate.
And do you have a sense that Trump has the will and the ability to do those things?
Yes, although I think in America, you sometimes need two terms to do it. Even with Reagan, America was a different country in 1988, because you have time not only to have the right policies. Look at the courts. The courts take time to change. Trump, I think, is on it in a way that we've never seen anyone be so on it. I think he also recognizes the importance of symbolism. He's very effective in popular culture. So I think he's, you know, in a very odd character, but nevertheless, the right man for this time. And I think he will deliver the goods.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the program, Dinesh D'Souza. Congratulations on your new book, new today, The United States of Socialism. Good luck with it, my friend. Thanks for being on.
Thank you very much.